Mark chapter 6, reading from verse 35. When it grew late, his disciples came to him and said, "This is a deserted place, and the hour is now very late." This is, of course, after the feeding of the 5,000. "Send them away so that they may go into the surrounding country and villages and buy themselves something for themselves to eat." But he answered them, "You give them something to eat." They said to him, "Are we to go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give it to them to eat?" And he said to them, "How many loaves have you? Go and see." When they found out, they said, 5 and 2 fish. Then he ordered them to get all the people to sit down in groups on the green grass. So they sat down in groups of hundreds and of 50s. Taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up to heaven and blessed and broke the loaves and gave them to his disciples to set before the people. And he divided the 2 fish among them all, and all ate and were filled. And they took up 12 baskets full of broken pieces and of the fish. Those who had eaten the loaves numbered 5,000 men. Right, it's got a picture for you now. Here is your starter. Lobster tail, accompanied by compressed fennel, a fennel puree and shavings, dressed with an orange gel and beurre blanc and lobster oil. And for the main, roast pork belly, pork tenderloin and a black pudding quail scotch egg, served with a pom puree, caramelised shallots and 2 sauces, an apple sauce and a honey mustard. And for dessert, vanilla chocolate panna cotta, topped with a tempered bitter chocolate tuile, with caramelised pears and a trio of hazelnut crumble biscuits. This was the menu that Natalie Coleman produced to win MasterChef 2013. And given the title of tonight's service, I thought you might like to see these marvellous dishes before we head back into some further reflections on the significance of food in the Bible.
It's what Susan's been giving us at Penrith Kitchen for years.
Yes, exactly. I didn't manage to see all of the MasterChef series this year. I don't know if you follow it conscientiously. But when I did manage to see the competitors whisking and cutting and seasoning and setting out these amazing creations for Greg and John to judge, I was amazed at the energy and the enthusiasm they put into the competition. Although I didn't see any of them washing up, which would have made it a bit more like real life. As we've seen, food is mentioned in many different contexts within the Bible. And in the next 20 minutes or so, I hope to take you on a journey through some of the references to food in our Holy Scriptures in relation to attitudes to food today. And I'll tell you later what inspired this particular topic. But the skiing metaphor, actually, of going off-piste keeps coming to my mind, or kept coming to my mind as I was preparing this. When we're moving from the nursery slopes and the green runs of our faith, developing our skills on the black and red runs of dialogue and discussion, and then moving out into fresh fields of snow. It's always a good idea to start out on the paths that have been prepared for us, to learn from others and from past experiences. But sometimes theological reflection on our own contexts can give us confidence to make new paths in the wilderness. There's a contemporary British theologian, Lisa Isherwood, and she's pointed out on the topic of food that the Bible uses food as a sign of many matters of divine importance, a sign of love, community, and the sacred. And these seem to be 3 broad categories that we could classify most of the Bible references to food under. And I'm going to develop my sermon tonight under these main headings, to consider ways that food represents a sign of God's love and provision for creation, ways we respond to that love through the use of food to represent the sacred. And of course, this is best seen in the way we remember Jesus and the Last Supper, when Jesus had said, "This is my body given for you." Although we're also going to look at other aspects of worship and the sacred. And of course, ways that food can be used as a sign of community. And of course, there's considerable overlap in these three categories. For example, in the reading we just heard of the feeding of the 5,000, it showed the love of God in Jesus' provision to the crowd. The community, of course, the 5,000 people, in my version, 5,000 men, 5,000 men and a load of extra women and children too, came together, the community that came together to share the food. And of course, the sacred in that miraculous provision to those in need. We've already seen a very different world in our discussions on food in the Bible, which mentions food so much because people then would have been hungry most of the time. And the idea of Jesus talking about heavenly banquets would have been really tempting. And has the world really changed? In the meditation we heard earlier, we remembered some implications of the effect that our consumerism has on the world, where 1 in 8 people live with the pain of hunger. The current IF campaign, with its strapline, "There's enough food for everyone if we all share," is highlighting God's call for justice in the world. The IF campaign is a huge coalition of UK-based organisations, including Christian Aid, who share the vision of a world where everyone has enough to eat. They're joining forces to petition David Cameron to use his presidency of the G8 to take a lead on hunger. Through the actions of these organisations and their supporters, and David Cameron's leadership of the G8, they can persuade governments to act. And when they do, everyone on this planet will have a chance of getting the food they need to live a happy and healthy life. And the emphasis there is on the word will. It's a very positive approach to this campaign. But of course, hunger isn't only an issue in the third world. Food banks are now opening across the UK to provide emergency aid to people referred to them by agencies such as the Citizens Advice Bureau. Of course, typically, a food bank distributes packages containing 3 days of nutritionally balanced, non-perishable produce to people in an emergency crisis. I was told recently about a food bank being set up in a Baptist church in the northwest of England, where a huge room is filled with food for needy people, a room that was used for Sunday school in the past and for meetings. There are food banks in Carnarvon and food bank on Anglesey, run by volunteers from the community and from churches. And we have to take this call to provide for those in need seriously. Back in the Old Testament prophet of Amos, Amos chapter 5, we read, "Even though you offer me your burnt offerings and grain offerings, I will not accept them. And the offerings of well-being of your fattened animals, I will not look upon them. But let justice roll down like waters, and righteousness like an ever-rolling stream." And this is for the provision of needs, not wants. The 5,000 may have wanted something more than bread and fish, especially with all the other gospel stories of rich food for the poor. You remember Mary's song of praise, we usually call it the Magnificat. "He filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich away empty." Maybe the picnic we heard about earlier could have been more interesting, but it does illustrate God's provision for our needs rather than for our wants. And of course, there are people who go hungry out of choice, not because they cannot eat, because they choose not to eat. The obesity crisis in the UK is becoming a problem for the NHS. But I'm not going to consider the possible causes of overeating, but briefly look at a particular form of dieting as shown in the Christian diet industry. You may be a bit surprised to discover that there is such a thing. But yes, indeed, there's such an industry, and as far as I can see, mainly based in America. Lisa Isherwood has written about this religious diet industry, which offers programs such as Slim for Him and Weigh Down workshops. And in these programs, the dieters are encouraged to reject food on their plate, not in any way to offer it to the starving or to the hungry, but for their own benefit. And she draws the conclusion that this can lead to an over-privatized God, the me-me God, the one who cares about me personally, but doesn't seem to notice the starving. And of course, there's a multi-million dollar corporate industry backing this up. So what reflection in this waste of food on their plates are we receiving here of the free gift of provision of God's love? We think of food as sacrifice. The sacrificial system is very apparent in the Bible, especially in the Old Testament. Food and other goods were presented as offerings as part of the religious practice of the time. And the priests encouraged this because they wouldn't have had time to grow their own food because they were performing their religious duties. The system of bringing the first fruits of the land to the priests was common in Bible times. And this can help us think about what we may bring in our offerings. The theme that I'm developing today was suggested to me listening to one of the worship leaders speaking a number of weeks ago. And she spoke about that morning how her children had bought her breakfast in bed. But the breakfast had been made by what small children have to have at hand, which is plastic food, plastic cereal, plastic fruit, plastic bananas. And this brought home to me the restrictions that are imposed by a limited choice of diet. We can see how a wider diet was encouraged in the New Testament times in the story in Acts of Peter and the sheet, which came down from heaven with a wide variety of food in it. And God said to him, "Take and eat." And he said, no, it's not pure food. It's not the sort I should eat. And the sheet was taken away and brought back. And of course, this was the start of Peter's mission and when he met Cornelius. And this is encouraging us to look wider beyond our own narrow vision. Charles Spurgeon was a significant Baptist preacher in Victorian times. And I think my favourite quote from him is about being open to dialogue and an awareness that God speaks in many ways, including through other people. And in one of his sermons, he criticizes the narrow-mindedness of people who say, "We do not hear anybody, and we will not read anything except the book itself. Neither will we accept any light, except that which comes in through a crack in our own roof. We will not see by another man's candle. We would sooner remain in the dark." And this is reinforced in a recent book on preaching, Alive to the Word, by Stephen Wright, who was at the time he wrote it a couple of years ago a lecturer at Spurgeon's College. And he warns against limited reading material of particular publishers, or the, as he terms them, popular devotional Bible commentaries. It's important to read wider. It's important, just like it's important to try new foods, both literally and metaphorically. Having a varied diet is important, as well as having a balanced diet, which unfortunately does not mean a chocolate bar in each hand. Jesus shocked people with his open table stories. The parable of the great dinner, when in Luke chapter 14, when the invited guests were too busy to come and the servants were sent out into the countryside. And there's a similar story in Matthew 22 about a wedding banquet, where not only did the people have to come to the party, but they had to be ready in appropriate clothing. And of course, as we were talking before, some of us mentioned the welcome back to the prodigal son. And in that, of course, we hear about the fatted calf and the rather peevish response of the older son to that celebratory feast. In a resource published by David McLaughlin, which I found on the Christian Aid website when I was researching for today and to support the IF campaign, he makes some points that I'm sure he'd be quite content for me to plagiarise right now. When he says that the Pharisees in particular clashed with Jesus. In an attempt to keep the purity of Jewish life, they had taken all the dietary and purity rules applicable to priests and temple practice and adapted them to the table of the home. You remember as well in the Gospels, it does describe about the counting out the tithe of herbs and how Jesus criticizing this practice that they're saying you've got to give your tithe out of everything. Because in the process, they effectively cut off the majority of the peasants of Galilee and Judea from their circle of holiness because they couldn't give the time and effort they needed to maintain their ritual practices. But Jesus, of course, he located the center of God's people differently, outside of those holy spaces. Jesus' meals became rituals of reversal, challenging the received wisdom of the religious and social elites. And they effectively witnessed to the breaking in of God's reign among the very people that these religious practices excluded. In Jesus, the sacred became available to the poor, the marginalized, and all those with whom he broke bread. And this is what makes the provision of food a community concern, especially when, well, there is enough food in the world, but there's an unequal distribution of it. And in situations where there is very little, experience shows that it is the poorer people who are generally more likely to share. David McLaughlin goes on to say that the appeal for daily bread in the Lord's Prayer speaks of this ever-present commonplace hunger. When their harvest fails, they starve. When their overlords call in too much produce, they starve. When resources grow limited, they resort to loans. And with loans from their neighbours, the assumption is that it'll be paid back interest-free, as and when possible. There are many impoverished communities who do share what little they have with their neighbour. And this is a big challenge to us here in the first world, to us, to me in particular as well, in our richer society where we are more likely to save and hoard our wealth. And of course, Jesus told a short story as well, a parable about the man who was building bigger and bigger barns to hoard his wealth. And just finally, there's just one further aspect of this community that shares. Natalie Coleman, the winner of MasterChef 2013, observed in a newspaper article that it was quite unusual for women to win the competition. Just as in the whole of the industry that she's hoping to move it into, most top jobs go to men. She said that professional cooking can be a man's world. as well as being a reflection on other parts of life as well. We can also see a glimpse of this in the Bible, in the story of Joseph when he was locked up in the prison cell. It was a master baker and the chief cupbearer who were there with him. Top jobs to the men, but generally on a day-to-day basis, food would have been prepared by women. You can see this in the Bible too. The ode to a capable wife in Proverbs 31. I'm sure you've heard that one before. And he describes that she rises while it is still night and provides food for her household and tasks for her servant girls. Rebecca, the mother, prepared the bowl of food for Jacob to obtain Esau's blessing from his father Isaac. Martha, as we mentioned, was busy with many tasks, which probably would have included the kitchen, while Mary listened to Jesus. Providing food is a motherly thing to do. So if we accept that the provision of food is a gift from God, are we also seeing the motherhood of God alongside the fatherhood? We do generally tend to focus on the fatherhood of God, but really, isn't God above gender? This was a point raised by this woman. There's a rather grainy picture coming up on the screen, I hope. I don't know if anybody could recognise her. Quite a major figure in Baptist history. She's Violet Hedger. She was the first woman to qualify officially as a probationer minister, which was in 1922. And in an article she wrote for the Baptist Quarterly in 1940, in the middle of wartime, she makes the point that the very use of the masculine, him, limits our thought. God is not a man. All life, the masculine and the feminine, is a tiny expression of his boundless thought and love. And all life is found within a balanced community, male and female, young and old, and through all the other differences which can be used to divide people, we all share the basic need for food, the basics of life, food, and enough food is provided in the boundless love of God. And maybe we could sum this up in the word from the meditation we heard earlier, which gives a recipe for a hunger-free world. If we combine all ingredients together, turn onto a floured board and knead well, keep at it and work hard, tell your story and listen to the stories of others, as we ourselves are worked together into a vibrant and diverse community. I feel we've certainly covered quite a lot of ground tonight in our exploration of some of the references to food in the Bible. Please feel free to discuss any of the issues I raised with me further. I really do like to talk about food, both physical and spiritual.